Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or independent financial advisor or an institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uesta. Today's topic is the perils of prediction and the principles of investing, inspired by the uncertainties of 2025 and two powerful thought experiments, John Ortheff's Hindsight Capital and Cliff Asness's 2035 Vision. I'm thrilled to be joined for the second time by my special guest, Dr. Adrian Saville, economist, investor, and academic, who will be joining us every second month with our new underlying podcast series aptly called The Long Game, where we will decode the complexity of investing and explore timeless principles for building resilient portfolios. Adrian is a professor in economics, finance, and strategy at the Gordon Institute of Business Science, or just GIBS for short, a leading international business school. He's also still involved in various bespoke projects within the financial services industry. Welcome back to the show, Adrian.
Thanks, Ron. It's great to be with you.
At the start of each year, financial forecasters confidently present their predictions, and year in and year out, reality renders most of them or us incorrect. Some miss by inches, most miss by miles. But the underlying problem is the same. Financial markets, economies, and geopolitics are dynamic systems that resist simple models and linear thinking. And like clockwork year in and year out, the complexity of systems makes nonsense of predictions about markets. In trying to figure out how to handle this uncertainty and what it means for investment decisions, there are at least two helpful guides. The first principle is what is when we look backwards, we can see how easy it is to be wrong, which means we can infer how difficult it is to anticipate what is coming. This gives us clues about just how uncertain we should be in thinking about the future. In essence, looking backwards tells us that the future is essentially unknowable. The second principle comes from a thought experiment. Imagine we are 10 years from now and that we are looking back from 2035. This travel through time can help our current selves imagine what might come to pass. While abstract, this thought experiment can help us be more objective about beliefs and biases, and this might help pull risk away from the opportunities we imagine based on forecasting the unknowable. Fortunately, some of the work has been taken out of our hands and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The first piece of work comes from Bloomberg's John Ortheff. At the end of each year, he writes an article for his imagined investment firm, Hindsight Capital, which makes fantastically astute decisions because they know, with the benefit of hindsight, what to buy and what to avoid. The fantasy shows just how hard it is to imagine what others or what each year can deliver. The second piece of work comes from Cliff Asness, co-founder of AQR Capital Management, who in a recent article leaps towards a decade, imagining the errors that will become evident in hindsight by 2035. Now, keeping this in mind, all this work in mind, Adrian, every year financial forecasters make bold predictions about the market, yet most miss the mark. Why do you think it is so hard to predict the markets?
So, Ron, you know, I think that these two exercises, Ortheff's Hindsight Capital and Asness's Imagine You've Got a Time Machine 10 Years From Now, you can look backwards, are just fantastic exercises or toolkits that, you know, abstract from market reality. And very often, abstracting from reality is a great way of just formulating models and frameworks for informing your investment philosophy. And, you know, the wiser, the better informed an investment philosophy, the more effective an investment process. So I love these two thought experiments. And perhaps we can come back to each of them in a moment. But, to answer your question directly, you know, why is it that we are so bad at forecasting? Is just the simple reality that financial markets, economies, geopolitics are complex, dynamic systems. And very small shifts in any one of those will quickly spill over into other facets. And, you know, just, you know, as we're recording this today, we're coming off the back of Trump's inauguration. We've made a couple of minutes without saying Trump. But we're just off the back of Trump's inauguration, and he's got his MAGA, Make America Great Again policies, and he's threatening to impose tariffs. Now, I can tell you a whole bunch of things, you know, about what textbooks tell us about tariffs. And I'm willing to, you know, make this speculation that those models are maybe hopelessly wrong would be unfair, but those models are wrong. And that almost everything you're reading about, you know, the way tariffs will unravel and what it will mean for markets and firm profitability and interest rates and inflation, well, you know, let's meet in 2, 3, 4 years' time and review the predictions that are made now. And overwhelmingly, the majority of these will be wrong because you've got a first action, the imposition of tariffs. You know, that will then have economic consequences that firms will have to stop importing, produce domestically. That will put inflation into supply chains. It might squeeze the profitability of some American firms that are now sheltered from imports, but producing domestically. It may have quality implications. Price or cost increases in the supply chain quickly spills into inflation. Then the Fed can't keep cutting rates. They have to start hiking rates. All of this is happening while China chooses to retaliate. Now, where are retaliatory tariffs in our modeling, et cetera, et cetera. So the world is extraordinarily complex and far more complex than any of our, or far more complex in our very best forecasting efforts. And, you know, sometimes we miss by inches. Generally, we miss by miles.
You and I have both mentioned that looking backward teaches us humility about predicting the future. But so do the two thought experiments. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah. And, you know, I won't spend time here talking about the evidence on forecasting. You know, that evidence is widespread. It shows you, well, I'll give you one example. Really interesting study that looks at the precision of analysts in forecasting S&P 500 earnings of S&P 500 companies forecasting their earnings. And the R squared on these forecasts over five-year periods is a 0.01 R squared. Now, for the statistical nerds, they'll quickly interpret this for us. They'll tell us that an R squared gives you the percentage that is explained. And a 0.01 R squared says that analysts are able to explain 1% of the variation in earnings forecasts. Just 1%. Essentially, the outcome is random. Yet, you know, we're clinging to forecasts as if somehow, you know, these people know something that everyone else doesn't. And, you know, to go to the two thought experiments, John Authors speaks about hindsight capital. And this is a lovely idea. So hindsight capital is a hedge fund. It can go long and short on stocks. And it's able to take its decision on the 1st of January, but it actually knows what the results look like on the 31st of December. So it can position itself for the year with perfect foresight because they've got a time machine that allows them to come back from the end of the year. And, you know, if we take the most recent report that he did, you know, of this fictitious hindsight capital, it did some obvious things. Hindsight capital went long on the Magnificent Seven, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, etc. That delivered a 70% return. But he funded that by going short on oil and energy stocks, the oil drillers before Trump, you know, said drill, baby, drill. And the net result is that that gave a return of 140% for the year. Then he bought French credit default swaps, and he bought those French credit default swaps by shorting German credit default swaps. That gave him a 95% return. He made a bet on Argentina. If we go to the end of 2023, Javier Milei has just been sworn in as president and sweeping reforms in Argentina, and the market gives 182% return. Now, hindsight capital was brave enough to go and put a big bet on Argentina, and that's where the 182% return comes from. But if I'd gone to my investor and said, I've got a big thought about Argentina, end of 2023, You know, I might have been shepherded quietly to a room without windows. So, you know, that's the idea of this hindsight capital is, even if I know, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, what's going to deliver these magnificent returns, I might have a hard time convincing you of the way things are going to transpire. So, you know, that's the first thought experiment. The other comes from Cliff Asness. And now he says, you know, let's not look back 1 year. Let's imagine 10 years from now and what that person 10 years from now would be telling our current selves about what we might not be seeing. And the way that Cliff Asness plays this game is he says, let's just look for everything that has got everyone, you know, salivating with enthusiasm. Magnificent Seven makes another appearance. Crypto, private credit, hedge funds or alternative assets, and US-centric portfolios. Anything with dollar in it is loved. And if we run through that list of five different things, it's a list of loved, 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 adored, you know, and absolutely infatuated. So when we get emotionally invested in things, you quickly get hype, and hype turns into inflated pricing. So he says, let's go 10 years forward, and we look back, and he imagines he's writing an investment letter to his clients. And he says, it's been a disappointing decade because that's where we were invested in those five loved things. And here's what's actually happened over the last 10 years. Value stocks have come back. International equities have outperformed U.S. equities. Trend following strategies have returned. They were abandoned because of volatility. Hard assets, especially commodities, have flourished because of inflation. Government bonds outside of the United States have done well. U.S. Assets, U.S. treasuries, by contrast, have battled. And, you know, if I filled the portfolio with those five things, you'd probably say to me, no, I want the first list, please. And so it just, you know, forces this introspection. You know, how can I be so sure about my portfolio positioning? It brings a sobriety to the way we position our portfolios. These are two fantastic thought experiments.
Adrian, we've just spoken about hindsight capital and some of its biggest takeaways, and also Cliff Asness' different approach. But how can investors actually use this perspective or these perspectives in their investment strategies?
So, Rowan, I think, you know, there's a couple of really big messages from this. The first is, you know, let's just take John Author's hindsight capital at face value. If I tell you now, we're doing this recording in January 2025 at the time that everyone is making their wild forecasts. And if I said to you, you know, here are the five things that are going to do fantastically well, and four of them just seem really unlikely. I'm going to tell you to, you know, short Italian government bonds or, you know, to buy German auto manufacturers. You know, like, no, I can't do that. No, I can't do that. And what we're likely to find if we, you know, let's agree to revisit this in 11 months' time, mid-December. And by then we will know the things that have shot the lights out. They probably aren't in most people's portfolios in big weight. You know, that's the first thing that, you know, authors is underlining, that what comes to pass, very few people see. And then, you know, the second lesson. So, let me make sure I've got your question. So what does that mean for your portfolio? Don't be scared to put esoteric things in. Don't be scared to, you know, build portfolios that are diversified away from the obvious and have some unusual things, some different things in there. You know, that might be one practical application. I'm not just, you know, I'm not suggesting fill your portfolio with crazy stuff, but look beyond the obvious. And be prepared for the unusual and the unexpected. Be prepared for surprise more than be prepared for certainty. That's what Authors is emphasizing. And then what Cliff Asness is really driving hard is, if you've filled your portfolio with all of the usual suspects, you might be making a mistake, because, again, history is a great guide here. Putting evidence up against Cliff Asness's 10-year thought experiment, history shows us that mean reversion is a very powerful force. The things that are loved, eventually the love goes away and they fall back to normal valuations. And things that are out of favor, I'm not talking about, beaten up, broken businesses or bankrupt governments. I'm just saying things that are, out of favor. They're good assets, good businesses, good governments, relatively well-run countries, decent currencies, but no one really wants them. That's where the pricing is most attractive. And that's what Cliff Asness is emphasizing is, when you look at your portfolio, perhaps just think hard about, is this filled with things that are easy to own because everyone loves them? Or, have I been dispassionate about this and thought more carefully about the quality of the assets that I own and the price that I'm paying for them?
Adrian, given all the uncertainty that we are, or the uncertain times that we are living in, let's shift to actionable insights. What are some of the key principles investors should follow in 2025?
So, what we're talking about here, Ron, is informed by a note that I'm writing at the moment for my investors, and I'll put down what I think are 10 really sensible principles that if we look back over time, some of the most successful investors are not trying to forecast what happens over the next day, quarter, or even year. They might have an eye on markets. They might be, reading with interest or listening with interest to commentary, but they're not sort of hair trigger sensitive and responding and reacting and trying to figure out with fourth decimal place precision what's going to happen. Instead, the way that they build their portfolios is they build their portfolios with philosophical architecture. And, here are the 10, and I'll try and not distract myself as I go through the 10 so that we can get them in lockstep. The first is they avoid market timing. The cost of missing some of the best days in the market is greater than the benefit of avoiding the worst. So they simply don't try and time the market generally. They accept volatility as part of the equation, and they don't try and get the greatest possible volatility. They're not trying to get volatility. They're trying to get the lowest volatility, but they accept that volatility is part of the equation. And so no market timing is the first principle that you see. The second is, and you and I have spoken about this on many occasions, I've written about this extensively, and this is the practice in my portfolios, is they diversify. It is the only free lunch that we get in investing. Now, in the case of this conversation, I would say that you diversify globally. You diversify by asset classes, by currencies, by geography, by industry, and you try and put more things into your portfolio rather than fewer things. U.S. equities have led for the last 15 years. Opportunities exist across emerging and developed markets. Don't ignore them. That's the second point. Diversify. The third is valuation, valuation, valuation. Price is what you pay. Value is what you get. That's a famous Buffett quote. And we want to buy, assets that are of good quality, but they only become good investments when you pay the right price. If you buy a great asset at an expensive price, you've just made a bad investment. Focus on valuation. And then, tangential to that or adjacent to that, point four is we prioritize quality. That bad assets at good prices aren't an investment. They're a gamble. So you want to find companies with strong, sustainable earnings, with moats that generate high returns on equity, strong balance sheets, governments that can service their debt, currencies that are well managed by sober central banks, and so on. And that's the emphasis point for quality. Slightly different to the first point of avoiding market timing, the fifth point that I would make is stay invested is one way of thinking about it. Perhaps to put it better, get invested as early as possible. Compounding is the single most powerful investment driver. there is nothing that will do more for your investment, your terminal investment result, than getting started as early as you can and then not interrupting yourself. If you are going to, point six, if you are going to fiddle with your portfolio, then have a disciplined process so that you aren't just tinkering for the sake of tinkering, and that, you know, each time you trim or you adjust your portfolio, you're doing it with the same consistency. In other words, there is a process that you repeat each time you revisit the portfolio. I've made point seven, but I'll make it again. Be careful of the consensus. Point eight is, more often than not, volatility is confused with risk. Volatility is bumpiness. Risk is permanent loss of capital. And, you know, it's always worth remembering that good assets go bad, or good assets can go bad. I shouldn't say they do go bad, you know, can go bad. And when good assets go bad, you land up owning a portfolio filled with Nokia, Kodak, Xerox, real estate after the global financial crisis, and so on. In my world, you might own Williams F1 or Wolverhampton Wanderers, which in distant passes were fantastic sports teams. But, you know, good things go bad. And if you filled your portfolio with things that are doing well, and because they're doing well, that's why you own them, you might be making a fundamental mistake. Point nine is, ignore the noise. If you're watching daily headlines, watch them for interest. Don't watch them for wisdom and information. And, you know, the last point is, you know, think about the long term. Do a cliff assness. You know, think about what your portfolio looks like over the next 10 years. And how do you position yourself for the decade, you know, not for the next? How do you position yourself for 2035 and not for the next 35 minutes or 35 days or even 35 months? Think about the decade. Think in decades. It's 10, which is, you know, a lot to jot down. Perhaps after this podcast, there's a way of sharing this. Or people can find it on my social media profile.
Before we wrap up, Adrian, let's touch on some current market trends, especially now that Trump's back in office. The U.S. equity rally continues, but risks are mounting. And what about U.S. treasuries, of course? The debt ceiling can only be raised that far, and someone has to pay all that back that debt at some point in time. How should investors approach this?
We could do a whole podcast, you know, just on this issue, but, you know, I would caution the confidence that has been placed in U.S. treasuries is it flies in the face of fiscal reality. The U.S. keeps bumping up against debt ceilings. They have got into the habit of not running deficits. They've got into the habit of running deep deficits. Economic growth has become increasingly fragile. Inflation, it looks like it is a growing threat in the U.S. I would put a very big question mark over the quality of U.S. treasuries. And then, you know, we need to inject into that equation the uncertainty that comes from Make America Great Again, the Golden Age, Trump's tariffs, etc. I'd be dramatic if I said I'd wave a red flag over U.S. treasuries, but I'd bring a very healthy dose of skepticism to the quality of U.S. treasuries as an asset class.
Adrian, what about China's economic malaise? Is it the new Japan?
You know, again, we find, you know, in investor enthusiasm, late 1980s, investors were filled with incredible passion for Japan that experienced decades of unbelievable economic and industrial performance. And then the rot set in, or perhaps the malaise set in. And, you know, Japan just went into sideways drift economically, but the market, because it had been priced for perfection, collapsed. Equity markets fell 80% from peak to trough. Property prices fell a similar figure. China is slightly different. I think China is in a structural bind that whilst they keep pointing to 5% economic growth, it's very hard to believe the elevation of that number. They just don't have that structural strength. When we've seen them throw money at the problem, as they did in the last part of last year, the market responded with a big woohoo, you know, leap for joy, given back a lot of that, suggesting that if anything, Chinese policymakers need to stimulate even more. But I don't think the problem in the case of China is stimulus. The problem is structural. They need to square up to their structural problems, and they simply haven't done that. So I would put a question mark over the strength of Chinese economic growth. However, Chinese assets are not priced euphorically. Chinese assets are priced for a very dark future. And for that reason, I am significantly more constructive on Chinese equities than U.S. treasuries. I'll put Chinese equities into my portfolio a long way before U.S. equities. U.S. treasuries. U.S. treasuries.
Adrian, this has been a very insightful discussion. Do you have any parting advice for investors for the year of 2025?
Well, Ruan, it's going to be no different than I would say at any other time, whether it was February 25 or March 1999. Stay disciplined. Predictions are interesting. Don't obsess about them. The best portfolios aren't built on prediction. They're built on preparation. Embrace uncertainty. Be prepared for the uncertain. And just inject these principles. There's 10 of them. It's a big list. It's a doable list. And if you apply those principles to your portfolios, you will have built portfolios that can endure.
Those are wise words. Thank you, Adrian. Well, that's all the time we have for today. And thank you, Adrian, for joining us on the show and highlighting the perils of predictions. We will speak to you again in March for another long game discussion. But to all our Citywire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Joester, and my producer, Vera Loba da Silva from the Citywire Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Oyono.fm. All Citywire South Africa podcasts and videos are also available on our website. So please go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.